Tavis Smiley, and pleased to have you hanging out with us today for this program, all 3 hours of it, and especially in this hour. Before I jump into this hour, let me just say that I say all the time that when I leave this studio every day, I leave smarter than when I came in. And every now and then, I just get I get chills, I get goosebumps when I think about the blessing that I have every day of being able to talk to people who are much smarter than I am. And today's been one of those days. I have just been I think when I leave the studio today, I'm just gonna levitate out of here. I ain't even gonna walk. I'm just gonna float. I'm gonna levitate out of here. Because it means something to me, and I hope for you, to be exposed to Black brilliance, to Black excellence. And I've just loved both of these conversations today in our first 2 hours. Mark Riley was amazing in that first hour. And what can you say about Chuck D? I mean, all these years later, that Negro still just dropping bars. And everything that Chuck says makes me think. When I think about Chuck, I think about KRS-One. And I've had the honor once in, was I in Paris? Or I think I was in Paris. But at one point, I had a chance to sit in a room with Chuck D and KRS-One. And when I tell you my head was spinning, sitting between them two brothers is quite a thing. So a chance to talk to either one of them, much less the two of them together, is it's a thing that you will never, an experience you will never forget. But I thank Mark and I thank Chuck for those first 2 hours. Just amazing, amazing conversations. And speaking of learning from brilliant Black people, this hour is no different. I am delighted to be joined by Boston Globe opinion columnist and associate editor Renee Graham to talk about all the stuff that Renee Graham writes about, and she writes about a little bit of everything. Renee, good to have you on this program. How are you today?
I'm good, Travis. How are you?
If I complained, I'd be an ingrate. I am doing well, and I'm delighted to be in dialogue with you. Let me just start with this, because it kind of, I think this hour, the first 2 hours sort of give us a nice flow into this final hour with you. And in a variety of ways, we've been talking over these last couple of hours with two great guests about our role and responsibility in the world as Black people, our role and our responsibility. That's taken on a variety of forms, of course, over the last 2 hours in terms of questions and answers. But when you are an African-American columnist and you have the platform that you have in the Boston Globe, tell me about your role and your responsibility, more expressly how you see it with the stuff you write about.
You know, it's interesting. I there's nothing I can't write about. My editors give me a lot of freedom to write what I want, how I want. And, you know, that allows me to delve into a lot of different topics. You know, I feel with the platform I have, we're in such a perilous moment mm-hmm. that I don't want to take this moment for granted. I don't want to waste having the space that I have, you know, several times a week. I mean, on average, I write about 3,000 words a week. And I want to make every single one of them count. So, you know, whether I'm writing about politics, whether I'm writing about pop culture, I want to make sure that I'm sharing something that matters with people. And, you know, whether they agree with me or not, and believe me, a lot of them do not, but for me, if they're writing to me and they're complaining, it still means that they're reading, which means they actually might be learning something.
Mm. You said a lot there that I want to unpack. Let me start with this. When you say that we are living in a perilous moment, I don't suspect that most listening to you right now would disagree with that. But when Renee Graham calls it a perilous moment in American history, by that you mean exactly what?
Well, I mean, look, I've been calling it a perilous moment for the last 8 years.
yeah.
I don't know how to compare this necessarily to what it was like during the Civil War or what it was like, you know, with Pearl Harbor. But I could speak within my lifetime of what is happening in this country, of my conscious lifetime, because I was too young to really remember the Civil Rights Movement, but my conscious lifetime of there has never been a more profound threat to democracy, which was already deeply flawed, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. than there is right now. And, you know, I can remember in the weeks leading up to January 6th, I kept saying around the house, there's going to be a problem, it's going to be bad, it's going to be bad. And everyone's like, no, it's not going to be a big thing. And, of course, you know what happened on January 6th. And on that day, it's in the column I wrote on January 6th, I call it a white supremacist insurrection. Mm-hmm. And I think the mistake people made is thinking that when people walked away from the Capitol that day, that it ended. No, it is not a failed insurrection. It is an ongoing coup. When I speak about the peril of this moment, that's what I'm talking about.
Do you see it getting better before it gets, do you see it getting worse before it gets better?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to get worse because I don't know that everyone, and I include the media in a lot of this, if they grasp what this is, I don't know that the media, and I speak very broadly about that because it, I don't mean absolutely everyone in the media, I mean that in a very general way, but I don't think they grasp the gravity of this moment, and you can kind of see in their coverage. Mm-hmm. You know, they still act, you know, I don't want to, you know, pick on Jonathan Carl, who works for ABC. I don't know Jonathan Carl. I don't want to pick on him, but, you know, he wrote a book and he talked about the circus. This is not a circus. This is not a show. This is not fun. Mm. You know, lives are at stake. Rights are at stake. And so I think the thing for a lot of people is, you know, we've always had the system of democracy, and it's gone through a lot, and it's still here. So I think there's a sense that it can't happen. Like, it can't fall apart. We can't become an authoritarian state. And this is a terrible example to use, but, you know, years and years ago, I used to work overnight, and I would complain and say, why do I have to work overnight? And they would always say, you know, in case a plane hits the Prudential Building, which at the time was, you know, one of the tallest buildings in Boston, they used to say that because that was the worst thing that could happen. Mm-hmm. No one thought a plane could hit a skyscraper. And then we got to, you know, September 11th. So the idea that the worst can't happen is absurd. You're dreaming. You know, I just want people to understand that everything we're seeing is part of a continuum. It's organized. It's well-funded. And, you know, there's a lot at stake. And if we aren't paying attention, we're pretty much going to lose everything we have.
It's going to be another great hour. I can tell already. When we come forward, I want to probe this notion of this notion that it can't happen here. There are many that believe that. We're still preaching this gospel of American exceptionalism, as if history doesn't record that every empire in the history of the world at some point has a reckoning. We'll talk about the fact that it can't happen here. There's a report out called the World Happiness Report. Americans have slipped from the top 20. What is, who is the culprit that has led to such unhappiness in our country? A great deal more to talk about with Renee Graham of the Boston Globe when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Interrogating and unpacking.
That's what we do around here.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
More of Renee Graham, opinion columnist for the Boston Globe, coming your way right about now. Renee's already said a few things that I want to spend the rest of the hour unpacking as we move through this this conversation. Renee, I was thinking of a few things over that break, and one of them is this notion that you were advancing or unpacking earlier, that so many Americans believe that what they see around the world, what they see happening around the world, could never happen here. We felt that way before 9/11, and I would like to think that we have sort of rethought that, and yet the evidence that I see every day suggests to me that we still haven't come to terms with how fragile our democracy is. We still haven't come to terms with where we are on the precipice. We haven't come to terms with history, which records again that every empire in the history of the world at some point has a reckoning. If I'm right about that, why am I right about that?
Well, you are right. I mean, you know, we've always looked at other countries. We've seen governments overthrown, and we've seen authoritarianism take hold. We've seen fascism. And there's always the sense that somehow our sense of democracy, if not democracy itself, will save us. And so, you know, we're having more debates about this now, but there are still places where people feel like we're going to be fine. You know, mm-hmm. we're going to be okay. You know, democracy has survived 250-odd years. It'll be great. And that just isn't true. There are too many countries. We've watched this happen in places that where things were much better, right, you know? And suddenly, here we are, we're now one of those countries. You know, I remember years ago watching MTV, and it was a Van Halen video, and it was just putting up different place cards about different things, and one of them was, right now, your country is doing things that you think happen only in other countries. Mm. That's the moment we're in now. You know, where we're looking at this, and we're seeing, you know, Brazil, and we can't look away in the same kind of sense and say, well, that's third world country over there. That's a banana republic, and that's mm-hmm. what happened. That's what's happening here. You know, so there was always a bit of, obviously, racism in the idea that, you know, those black and brown people, they don't know how to govern, they don't understand how things go. Well, look at where we are now, where we're on the, you know, the distinct possibility that someone facing 91 felony charges, or well, almost 90 now, about felony charges can possibly be the next president of the United States.
Yeah.
There's no reason for anyone to think that democracy is safe. If you do not tend to democracy at all times, it will wither and die. And that's the path we're on right now.
What are some of the things on your list, some of the sources of the fragility of our democracy? I hear you talking about Donald Trump, and we'll get to that. But are there other things on your list that you think have led to our democracy being so fragile in this present moment?
I think one of the first things, you have to go back a decade to Shelby v. Holder, the Supreme Court, gutting the Voting Rights Act. I don't know if up to that point most people were aware that that could happen. You know, the idea that, oh, you know, this was 1965, you have this right, and it's sacrosanct and nothing can happen to it. And when the Supreme Court essentially came in and said, when John Roberts said, well, you know what, I think racism is kind of over. We really don't need that anymore. It changed everything. You know, the ways that a lot of states, the states that were being most closely watched, immediately zoomed in and tried to have all these different voting laws suddenly that didn't exist before and were never necessary. That was the first real moment. And I don't really think it hit people until probably 2016, which was the first presidential election after that Supreme Court decision, and certainly in 2020 that, oh, wow, you know, there's something happening in the way people vote, and we know that that's happening. That's the first moment. And if you know, voting is the foundation of our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
If that's under threat, everything else goes with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that should have been a wake-up call for a lot of people. But as I said, I think people are just in such deep states of denial, especially if they're not in a state where it's happening. You know, I live in Massachusetts. I'm not worried about somebody asking me for my ID when I vote. It's illegal to do so. But there are lots of people who do live in those states, and then they have ID, or they're getting purged from voter rolls. All these things are constantly happening, and I feel like nobody's watching.
Yeah. I want to go back to your comment earlier, Renee, about the perilous moment that we are in. For you, that perilous moment has been ongoing for about 8 years now. But I don't want to color this question much more than this. I think you'll take my point. As a columnist who's writing about all kinds of issues every day, what's your sense of the condition of truth in our country? The condition of truth. What's your sense of the state of truth in this democracy?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's eroding. I don't know that this, you know, there aren't really absolute truths anymore in the way that we once had them. And, you know, you know, I get emails all the time. I might mention something about saying Donald Trump being racist, and people will say, prove to me he's racist. Show me one thing he's ever said that's racist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, how much time in a day? Like, you're literally sitting at a computer. You can Google this yourself and find out. But that's kind of where we are. You know, it's just everything. It's like, you know, another one of those moments that really was shattering was the aftermath of January 6th. When you still had 147 Republicans refuse to certify the election. Like, that should have been the moment when everybody said, okay, we all saw what happened. We were running for our lives. We have to sit here and just say this was nonsense. We're going to. They didn't do it. That the election denialism is still going on. A majority of Republicans still believe that was stolen. That the 2020 election was stolen. That's the state of truth in America, that they have not a shred of evidence to the contrary, but they somehow believe that Joe Biden was not legitimately elected. That's the state of truth.
Mm. I was sort of chuckling earlier, Renee, when you said that you get a lot of mail from folk who don't agree with you when you write your columns in the Boston Globe, and I know what that feels like. I've gotten a bunch of mail over the course of my career when people didn't agree with me, and that's okay. I tell folk all the time, I recognize, you should know, that I do not have a monopoly on the truth. Furthermore, mm-hmm. you should recognize that I understand that there is the truth and there is the way to the truth, and you got to be humble enough to understand, as I try to be, that I don't have a monopoly on all the truth, and you got to be gracious enough to accept that fact that some people just ain't found their way yet to the truth that you know. And so that doesn't mean that we're not obligated to share what we see, to tell the truths that we know, but other folks just haven't arrived there yet. We don't all wake up at the same time, literally or figuratively. We don't wake up at the same time. I get that. And yet, sometimes you see stuff that people send you where they disagree with you, but it's not rooted in any reality. The disagreement, the difference, their point of view is not rooted in any sort of reality. And I'm seeing more and more of that these days. It's making me question the mental state of our demos. That's me. What say you?
I mean, I agree. I mean, it's very hard to argue with people who simply have no capacity to see the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What they're interested in is what confirms their personal narrative, what confirms their personal bias. And anything that falls outside of that circle, they're not interested in. So, you know, they will sit back and they'll tick this off, and, you know, Donald Trump accomplished this, and he did this, and I'm like, yeah, actually that was Obama who did that. No, it wasn't. It's like, you can look it up, but it doesn't matter. Like, you can say to someone, look it up, and they look like, oh my God, you're right, I was wrong. They're never going to admit that they were wrong, because they need to believe this. They need to believe this was true. The same way that they needed to believe that, you know, January 6th was just a riot that got out of hand, or a parade that got out of hand, and people got over, you know, they need to believe this, because it justifies, like, it's their identity at this point. You know, I mean, it's not just the politics. It's literally their flesh and blood. It's who they are.
Yeah.
And who they are is that lie. And if you push against that lie, in their minds, you're almost threatening their lives. It's, I mean, sort of literally, but figuratively as well. But, you know, they're just threatening the core of who they are and how they see their place in the world. And they have no capacity for that, so all they could do is cling to the lie.
It is not as if after this election in November, the country is going to make a U-turn. And so I guess my question is, what gives? We're having this conversation today, but by your own admission, things are going to get worse before, if they ever get better. What happens to the future of this democracy if this is as good as it gets?
Then if this is as good as it gets, if each day is worse than the day before,
mm-hmm.
Then democracy falls, then fails.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really all there is to it. I don't see any other scenario, because, you know, there is a presidential candidate who is not interested in saving democracy. And his entire emphasis is on tearing democracy down and dismantling it. So, you know, if the election goes a certain way, and look, and I don't necessarily think that if Joe Biden wins in November, that democracy is now saved. It's not going to stop. People are going to continue to threaten it. The Supreme Court is still going to be the same Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So people are continue to threaten democracy as we know it. The tragedy of that is we've never really fully grasped and embraced democracy in this country. There were always people who were kept outside of it. Even after 1965, even after the Civil Rights Act in 64, there were always people who were kept outside of it. And so if there was this idea that we were at least marching forward, but slowly, now we're retracting. You know, now we're sliding further and further back from the incomplete place we already were. So
yeah.
I don't see how democracy holds, certainly if one candidate wins, but I don't think democracy is necessarily saved if the other one does.
And see, that's my dilemma. It's the conversation that nobody really wants to have. But if you assume that things are only going to get worse, that people are going to be more entrenched, that people are going to be clinging more with a greater grip to their alternative facts, that we do not have objective truths anymore, that people are in their silos now more than ever, that people are becoming more nativist now more than ever. If you assume that all of that is true, and it is in real time, and you assume that all of that gets worse, then to your point, we are headed inexorably toward a moment that cannot be stopped. And that moment is that the democracy, or the experiment in democracy, just falls flat. It collapses. I always refer to it as an experiment in democracy. This audience knows that we have a Madisonian framework for democracy, but you and I agree we've never quite really honored that. And so I call us an experiment in democracy. But here we are trying to export this thing called democracy around the globe. And unless you see something I don't see, unless you know something I don't know, I think we are hurtling toward a moment where the democracy ultimately just fails. It falls flat unless something arrests that development. And I don't see what that something is, Renee.
I think that's exactly it, Tavis. I don't see what that something is either. You know, I've said for a long time that if this had been a healthy democracy to begin with, Donald Trump could never have become president.
Mm.
Because people would have rejected him. People would have said, this is not the direction this country needs to go in. If this had been a healthy democracy, there would have been an absolute truth about what happened on January 6th. We didn't get that. You know, people would have, you know, there would have been a concession speech in 2020. There would have been an idea that, hey, this guy lost, this guy won, and now we move on to the next administration. That didn't happen. That just didn't happen. And so, you know, I don't see how democracy survives this moment. There isn't, I think it was maybe like probably about 8 years ago now, people in South Korea wanted the president gone. There had been a lot of problems, a lot of corruption. And they were out on the streets day after day, week after week. And they even arranged it around their work schedules. You know, so they would do it on the weekends. But there would be hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Seoul and other parts of South Korea to get her out of office. And they're like, we're not going to go home until she's gone. And eventually, she was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's this weird sense that people are kind of, you know, walking along and everything feels normal, but it's not normal. We haven't been normal in a really long time. And so I think that, again, as I originally said, I think people just don't think that thing can happen. It's, you know, to use another bad example is, you know, in Boston we have Patriots Day, and mm-hmm. the Boston Marathon is always on Patriots Day, and we have to work. That's a day off for everyone else. It's never a day off for us. And the reason always being that if something bad happened at the marathon, and the comment used to be, in case someone blows up a bomb at the marathon, we need to have people on staff. But, of course, we thought, again, that would never happen.
Yeah.
And then 2013 happened.
It happened, yeah. Yeah,
there's always a sense the worst can't happen until it does.
Now, I take your point. And moreover, if the abnormal in this country, this abnormal state that we are in, is in fact the new normal, then we're going down a rabbit hole unless something happens. And again, at least as Renee is concerned, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see what that something is. What I do know is that Renee is writing about race and racism and police violence and gun reform and politics and so much more to the tune of about 3,000 words a week, as she mentioned. And there have been a couple of pieces of late that she's put her pen to, or her typewriter to. I'm not sure how she writes. But I want to interrogate a couple of those. I mentioned a moment ago this World Happiness Report that is out, and Americans have slipped from the top 20. What is the culprit of our unhappiness in this country? Renee Graham has the answer. She'll tell us that and a great deal more when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
For all the freedom-loving folk, this is Tavis Smiley.
I feel like freedom.
Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley. That's who. The conversation continues right now.
It does indeed with Boston Globe opinion columnist and associate editor Renee Graham, who I am enjoying talking to in this hour. So, Renee, there are a couple of things you've written about of late that I want to jump into right quick. I think I want to do this first. We were talking about the state of our democracy and the fragility of it, and Donald Trump and all the like. I was fascinated by your piece that Trump keeps boasting and bragging and acting like he's anxious to debate Joe Biden because he wants to get him, I think, in the spotlight where he can sort of embarrass him around this issue of his mental acuity. But you don't buy the argument that Trump really wants to debate Joe Biden that bad, do you?
I don't. I mean, look, Donald Trump had a bunch of debates he could have been in during the primary season. You know, he had 5 debates. Every single one of them he turned down. So why now is Donald Trump so eager to get on a debate stage? I don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Let me play devil's advocate. He didn't want to debate those Republicans, one, because there's no real reason to do so if there was no evidence that suggests they ain't them had a chance to even touch you. Why put yourself out there if none of them can come close to you? And as it turned out, nobody came close to him. So why waste your time debating with folk that aren't worthy of being debated with when you're the front runner by so far they can't lay a glove on you? That won't be the case with Joe Biden, number one. And number two, the argument that I made a moment ago that perhaps he can, you know, get Joe Biden to make a gaffe on national television and just seize the moment.
Well, You know, I always think there's this idea with Trump where what he wants to do is control the narrative. He wants to control the setting. Mm-hmm. He can't do that in a debate. And so it's very interesting that not only did he not show up for the debates with his Republican opponents, but he always held some sort of counter event where he could sort of wail on and on for 2 hours, or he'd be on Fox News where he'd have softball questions thrown at him. He wants to be able to control that, and he can't do that on a debate stage. If his whole idea of getting on a debate stage is, I'm going to make, you know, Joe Biden look like he's mentally incompetent, well, A, Trump might show more people that he might be mentally incompetent, but also he's going to have to answer for a lot of things. The rhetoric he's had lately, mm-hmm. his stance on abortion, which has been kind of all over the place because he doesn't really want to commit to a national abortion ban. All of these sorts of things are going to add up, and yeah. he can't just go into some rant about something else the way he does. You know, what Donald Trump wants, he likes a monologue. He doesn't like a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't really know that. I don't believe that he really wants to be a debate stage. And look, it's going to come up, I'm sure.
Sure.
You know, so we will see. But, so, you know, he was talking about that a few weeks ago. He's not saying anything about it lately.
Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking about, and I think you'll appreciate this being a writer and a journalist yourself, I've had any number of occasions over the course of my broadcast career where I have been granted exclusives or interviews with certain people, and they agreed to sit with me, Renee, but only if their attorney were in the room, only if their attorney was nearby. And the reason for that was because, obviously, there were certain things their attorney did not want them to say, certain areas of inquiry that they would not allow their client to go into, even as they agreed to give me the exclusive conversation with said person. I've had a number of these occasions over the course of my career. I raise that because it's going to be awfully difficult to see Donald Trump and Joe Biden engage in debates where you know there are going to be questions about his legal situation or situations, plural. These are going to come up. And I don't know, again, everything about this Trump candidacy is unprecedented. This moment is unprecedented. As you say, it's a perilous moment. It has been for 8 years or more. But I'm trying to wrap my brain around how we do debates where there are going to be questions about his legal situation, but your attorney can't sit next to you on stage and tell you can't answer that question. They're not going to tell the moderator he can't answer that question. That's going to be a hot mess, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. Look, if I'm his attorney, I'd be sweating bullets through that because you know Donald Trump is not going to be capable of controlling himself. He lost a case for defaming E. Jean Carroll. He still can't shut up about
mm-hmm.
E. Jean Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's all the evidence anyone needs. He's got all of these court cases that at some point he's going to say something about the judge, the lawyers, about the case itself. And that's going to blow the whole thing open. So, again, if I'm his lawyers, you know what I think this is? It's like every time Donald Trump has been in court, they always say, he absolutely wants to testify. He wants to testify. He never does.
Mm-hmm.
It's all empty flexing. And that's what I think this is. I think it comes from that same exact place where it's like, yeah, I can take them on. I want to do this. But then push comes to shove, he doesn't actually do it.
Yep. Over the course of my career, I've interviewed people and talked to them and had lunch and dinner with a lot of people. Lunches and dinners who are on the Presidential Debate Commission. I've known some of them personally over the years. And I've been really thinking about this because I don't know how they're going to handicap this in a way that is fair to Joe Biden, but in a way that Trump's lawyers also can agree with that won't get him into trouble. And it may very well come down to the fact that there can be no questions asked about his legal situation. But I don't think the American people are going to go for that. You can't be in a debate running for president with all these cases going on, and then we're supposed to accept the fact that for legal reasons, you can't answer questions about these. I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, I digress on it for now, but I'm already thinking ahead of September when we get to that sprint between Labor Day and Election Day, where these debates typically happen, usually two or three of them. We'll see. But I think it's going to be some tricky terrain for the Presidential Debate Commission and for the moderators and certainly for Mr. Trump himself to try to navigate those treacherous waters without getting himself in a great deal more trouble. We shall see. I assume, though, and I'll let you respond. I assume, Renee, that he won't have the success. I mean, your argument is that he doesn't really want to debate Biden that badly anyway. But my assumption is that just because he got away with not debating these Republican candidates that he won't get away with that. Not that he suggested. I read nothing where he said he doesn't want to debate Joe Biden. But my sense is those debates are going to happen whether he wants them to happen or not.
Right. But I also think what's going to happen is he's going to agree to a debate, and then at some point he's going to drop out because he'll say there was some rule or regulation they tried to spring on him at the last moment, and that was unfair, and it was just very unfair to him. And he's going to do the same thing he always does. He's going to, again, it's going to be an empty flex. I wanted to do this, but they tried to pull a fast one at the end, so I'm not doing it now because now we don't play like that. That's not what we do.
Yeah.
I do not think, again, he wants to be on that debate stage because the problem is it's not just going to be him and Joe Biden.
Yeah.
It's going to be him, Joe Biden, and a panel of moderators.
Yeah.
He can't predict what those questions are going to be.
No, I can hear him now. It wasn't good. It wasn't good. It wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. He grabs two or three words. He just rides with it. It wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. It wasn't good. It wasn't good. I'm out. Not gonna happen. Her name is Renee Graham. I am Tavis Smiley. I'm glad to have you tuned in. When we come forward, straight to this conversation about why Americans are so unhappy. Not just so unhappy, but according to the World Happiness Report, we are unhappier than we have ever been, and Renee Graham thinks she knows why. She's written about it, but she'll talk about it when we come forward.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. Smart talk for curious people just like you. You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and the Boston Globe opinion columnist and associate editor, Renee Graham. So, Renee, the World Happiness Report tells us that Americans have slipped from the top 20, that we are not just unhappy, but we are unhappier than ever. And the culprit for that, to your mind, is what?
Well, the culprit, there's a lot of culprits, but, you know, I mean, America's never been in the top 10 of the happiest countries. We've always sort of bounced around the bottom 10 of the top 20. But we landed at 23 this year, and the reason they said primarily is because of the unhappiness of young people. And, you know, it's out of 143 countries, Americans under 30 ranked number 62 compared to baby boomers who ranked a 10. So what is making young people so unhappy? And the report, which is done by the UN and Columbia University and Gallup and other institutions and organizations, came up with the term the inequality of well-being. And what it essentially says, if you do not have the things that are crucial for your well-being, like a steady income, education, healthcare, housing, social acceptance, a supportive social environment, family, community, all of these things, if you don't have those things, they weigh down, they impact your happiness. And the people who live in countries who have those things, who aren't worried about how they're going to pay their bills if they get sick or don't have the money to afford even basic housing, remarkably, they're a lot happier than we are.
Mm. And yet, and I'm not naive in saying this, of course, and yet we are the richest nation in the history of the world. How can a nation that is so wealthy have people who are so unhappy?
Well, you know, if we're the richest nation in the world with probably the worst gap in income and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of wealthy people in America, but we know what the other side looks like, and it keeps getting, that gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And you can't feel happy if you are in a constant state of panic about the most basic things, like keeping a roof over your head or food on your table. This isn't just, you know, inflation's high and it costs a lot to put gas in my car. This is something much more fundamental. And, you know, something that the report said is that, and I'm quoting here, well-being and happiness are critical indicators of a nation's economic and social development, which should be a key aim of policy. That's the whole thing right there. The policies that governments make should be benefiting people's well-being instead of putting them on a much uneven footing or threatening their rights. If that's those are the things, people want action that makes their lives better, and they're not getting enough of that, and young people are really seeing that.
We were talking earlier in this conversation, in case you missed it, you tuned in late. We were talking with Renee Graham of the Boston Globe earlier about the fragility of our democracy. And it seems to me that it's not a far stretch from people being perennially unhappy to feeling a sense of hopelessness. And when hopelessness sets in, you take my point, your democracy is in trouble. I heard many moments with Renee Graham when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Progressive. Unapologetically black. 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 You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
More of Renee Graham right about now. The last 3 minutes I have on today's program, Renee Graham is a Boston Globe opinion columnist and associate editor. I think I want to wrap this conversation, Renee, kind of where we began, and that is this notion, again, of our democracy. And you use this phrase about whether or not democracy will hold. Will democracy hold? We were talking about how unhappy so many Americans are, certainly our young people. And I read another survey not too long ago that found that for the first time ever, more Americans believe that our best days are behind us than any prior poll. That more Americans believe our best days are behind us. How does, to your mind, democracy hold if most of our fellow citizens believe that our best days as a nation are already behind us?
That's a tough question. I understand exactly why people feel that way. At the same time, and look, I'm a Mets fan, so optimism is not my default setting.
That's funny.
But, okay. But you know, if people are just going to sit back and sort of like gnash their teeth and wring their hands, then it is going to completely fall. Mm-hmm. There has to be a way to fight back. We've seen other countries do this. We've seen other countries try to wrest themselves from the grips of authoritarianism and fascism. If we don't do that, we're going to be in the place where we don't want to be. And so I completely understand, and I certainly feel it myself, it's easy to feel defeated. It's easy to feel like there's nothing I can do.
Yeah.
There has to be something. Yeah. You know, this country has fought for its democracy before. You know, if you talk about something like World War II, the country knows how to do that. This is a very different kind of fight. And there has to be that same kind of effort. But I think it's harder sometimes to fight the enemy within.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to look across the pond and say, oh, those people are the bad people. But this time, the people are your neighbors and your coworkers, and for some people, in their families. And that's very hard to recognize, which makes it difficult to fight.
Yeah. So I lied. That wasn't my exit question. Here's my exit question, one of what you just said. How do they let a Mets fan work for the Boston Globe?
You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. Look, I'm not a Yankee fan. See, that's the key.
Yeah, that's the key, yeah.
You see, so that's why I'm allowed in the door, because I'm real for the Mets, not the Yankees.
Yeah, I can only imagine if you were a Yankees fan, they wouldn't let you in the door at the Boston Globe, but I digress.
Oh.
Yeah.
It would not be safe.
I take your point. Her name is Renee Graham, Mets fan though she is. She lives in Massachusetts, and she works for the Boston Globe, where she's an opinion columnist and an associate editor, and I have immensely enjoyed this conversation with Renee Graham. Renee, good to have you on. We'll do it again. All the best to you.
My absolute pleasure, Tavis. Thank you so much.
A great delight to have you on this program. And just like that, 3 hours gone. Back here tomorrow, Lord willing, to do it all over again. Until tomorrow, thanks for tuning in to Tavis Smiley. And as always, keep the faith.